zippity-doo-da, zippity-yay. My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
This is Lee Habib, and you're listening to Louis Armstrong singing zippity-doo-da from the Disney movie Song of the South. And 49 years ago on this day in history, Walt Disney passed away. A simple Missouri kid whose dreams were more than simple. They were magical and never dreamt before. But he didn't just dream, he pursued them, even when no one believed his dreams could become real. And almost no one ever did. And even when bankruptcy stared him straight in the eyes, he continued on until he won, until his dreams won. And we're glad he did. And I'm sure glad that he did too, because in the end, well, he touched all of our lives. The creator of Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Pinocchio, Dumbo, Disneyland, and Walt Disney World. He won more Academy Awards than anyone in history, transformed cartoons into an art form with lifelike characters that audiences could relate to. He created the first cartoon with synchronized sound and the first full color cartoon. We could just keep going on. For the entirety of our show today, we'll be celebrating Walt Disney's life on the day that he died, and for our This Day in History segment brought to you by our sponsor, Hillsdale College. But we really needed more time than one show. Maybe next year we'll do a whole week on the 50th anniversary of this man's death. Joining us now for the whole first hour is a man a little bit obsessed with Walt Disney. Studying the man is almost like a second career for our guest, Pat Williams. Pat is the author of over 80 books on leadership, including How to Be Like Walt, a book so inspiring that you simply can't put it down until you're done. I'll tell you, to make a great Christmas gift for any of your loved ones. Pat is also the co-founder and senior vice president of the Orlando Magic. Pat, as always, thanks for joining us.
Lee, great to talk to you. And anytime I get to talk about Walt Disney, well, that's a good day for me.
Hey, let's start at the beginning, Pat, because it's interesting. Although Walt Disney wasn't alive for the founding of the Orlando Magic, without Walt, there wouldn't be a Magic, would there?
Probably not. I moved down here to Orlando almost 30 years ago with the goal, the dream of helping to bring an expansion NBA basketball team to Orlando. And we were successful in that venture. We're now in our 27th season. But in addition to that basketball dream, I'll tell you what else happened to me, Lee. I got Disneyized, which is very easy to do when you come to visit Orlando. And I got particularly fascinated with the life of Walt Disney himself. I began to run into senior Disney executives here who had worked with Walt back in California. And I was always picking their brain, always asking them to tell me about Walt. And that eventually led to a book called Go for the Magic, in which I wrote about Walt Disney's five secrets of success. And then that led to the biggie, How to Be Like Walt, in which I tracked down every single person I could find who knew Walt, wrote about him, or had worked with him back in the day in California. And it was a fascinating project. And so I'm completely absorbed in the life of Walt Disney.
Well, that sounds like just a heck of a lot of fun also. But let me get to this. One of Walt's greatest legacy is as the dreamer, which we'll cover more in the next segment. But for now, talk about the size of his dreams and how in the heck he came to them.
Well, Lee, I will tell you this. They were huge. You know, he never dreamed small dreams. His background is very interesting. He grew up originally in Chicago. A rather dysfunctional family. His dad was very hard on him. They did not have a strong relationship, with Walt as a youngster. Eighth grade education, that was the extent of Walt's formal education. And eventually, you know, they moved to a farm in Missouri. Walt loved that period in his life. But throughout this, he was a drawer. He was an artist, not a world-class artist, but loved to draw, loved to create characters, and he was always thinking, you know, about where this might lead. So as a youngster, still in his teens, he was working for the Kansas City Star newspaper in the art department, and they fired him. said he was lacking in creativity. His imagination wasn't good enough. And so at that point, Walt vowed he would never work for anybody else again, and he would always be his own boss. And I think that was a key point in his career, in his life, when he made that decision. He always wanted to be in control of what he was doing.
You know, there was an interesting quote I wanted to read to you, and tell me what you think it means. But Walt said, "I must explore and experiment. I am never satisfied with my work. I resent the limits of my own imagination."
Now, that's a good point, Lee, and that's why movies were so frustrating to him. He would try and get them to be absolutely perfect, but inevitably something would pop up, and just when the film was finished, he'd see something that he didn't like or that could have been better, and he'd try and fix it, but in many cases he couldn't. And, you know, once that movie is done, it's done. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. That's why when Disneyland came along much later, Walt was so excited about that, because he could constantly be working on it, constantly be improving it. It was never finished. And if there was a flaw, Walt could always correct it and make it better. I think that's why he enjoyed Disneyland so much.
Well, for the hour, Pat, we're going to be talking more about Walt Disney. I wanted to read one more quote that I just found so fascinating. We're going to go to a break and come back. This is Walt Disney. He said, "If management likes my projects, I seriously question proceeding. If they disdain them totally, I proceed immediately." That may seem like the statement of someone who is just plain ornery, but in reality, it's an expression of Walt's creative genius. Walt believed that if everyone around him approved of his ideas, then he wasn't dreaming big enough dreams. Only when people opposed his ideas was he sure that the challenge was bold enough. This is Lee Habib, joined for the hour by Pat Williams, who wrote, I think, the best book on Walt Disney, How to Be Like Walt. When we come back, more about this extraordinary life on this day in history, brought to you by Hillsdale College, the day Walt Disney died. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, we're going to be talking about the great Walt Disney, who died on this day in history. And we're joined by Pat Williams, who's written over 80 books on leadership, including How to Be Like Walt. And Pat, thanks so much for joining us.
Lee, my pleasure. Thank you.
You know, I just read you something about, well, how Pat dealt with naysayers. And it turns out, Pat, that the very first naysayer in his life may actually have been his dad. Talk about that.
Oh, I think that's true, Lee. His dad was rough on him. You know, the fact that Walt loved to draw and do artwork, you know, I think Elias Disney couldn't comprehend that. And at one point he said, "Why don't you play the violin? You can always be in a band." And so there was a struggle there. There was a tension there. Well, let's face it, Walt was a... I can just picture him as a young kid, Lee, probably very much a free spirit, probably not the easiest kid to parent, but his dad and Walt had their problems. And now eventually, you know, that was resolved. Years and years later, Walt brought his parents out to Los Angeles after he was up and running, and you know, it was a different relationship then, but as a young boy, it was, I would describe it as strained.
That's tragic, actually, but he did gain something from his dad, as you pointed out, and that was his father Elias's Protestant work ethic. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, his dad was a worker. You know, he was involved in many different forms of work, but he was a worker. And so is Walt. Let's not ever forget the fact that, you know, Walt just didn't come into this world with pixie dust, you know, scattered all around him and had this free ride to all that he did. He was an incredible worker, never took time off, really. You know, he lived in that office and probably worked to a fault. Although, when you really study him, Lee, he was a great husband and a great father. You know, he always took time for his two girls. He was a good husband to Lillian. And he knew that he wanted to spend time and take time to be with his family. Drove the girls to school every morning. So he was very conscientious in that regard. But the rest of the time, oh boy, he was deeply immersed in his work. Always working, always thinking, always planning, always dreaming, always imagining, you know, what could happen. And earlier, Lee, you made the point that if everybody opposed an idea, Walt was for it. And that was the case. You know, if people agreed with him, Walt said, it's not a big enough dream. And so he would let them know he was thinking about making a full-length animated cartoon, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Unheard of. Cartoons were 8 minutes at the longest. And if you went 8 minutes and 10 seconds, probably the whole world was going to collapse. And so he came up with a full-length cartoon. And then years later, along came Disneyland. And Walt had the whole thing pictured in his mind. Nobody bought in. His brother Roy thought he was nuts. I mean, there was not enough money to do it. His team was very much opposed. And Walt took that as a good sign.
Yep, he took it as a good sign.
If they're all opposed, it's going to work.
It's going to work. You know, one of the things he may have learned from his dad also is this ability to survive failure and also to incur and take on risk and have an appetite for risk, Pat. And one of the most incredible things about Walt's life is how he kept daring over and over again, pushing himself until he went into bankruptcy or close to it as a young man. Talk about Walt's failures, because as so many of us learn in life, we grow the most and learn the most when we fail.
Well, Walt said, there was a wonderful quote. He said, "I think it's important for anybody to have one good failure early in their career." And listen, Walt had his share of failures. He went bankrupt, as far as I can determine, Lee, 12 times. Two nervous breakdowns, many a setback. But the biggest setback occurred in 1927. He finally had come up with this delightful character, Oswald, the Lucky Rabbit. So he went to New York to check up on Oswald and see what was going on with his films and all. And he got the horrifying news that a New York huckster named Charles Mintz had pilfered Oswald on a legal technicality and had swiped all of Walt's key animators as well. So there is 27-year-old Walt with his new bride, Lillian. He gets this horrible news in New York. And what does one do? Well, he got on a train with his wife and headed back to Los Angeles. Well, Lillian later said, she said, Walt was so down, so dejected, he just lay there. He couldn't even sit up. Finally, about halfway across the country, Walt began to revive, and he always had a thing for mice. So he sketched out a mouse. He was quite pleased with it. Already had a name for the mouse, Mortimer. Came over to Lillian's seat, showed her what he had done. Lillian was horrified. "Far too sissy a name," she said to Walt. So Walt went back to the drawing board while there on the train, and when the train arrived at the L.A. train station, Walt had a new mouse, a new character, a new mouse with a new name. We've all heard of him. And years later, Walt said, "I hope we never lose sight of the fact that it all started with a mouse." And he also said, I never loved a woman as much as I loved that mouse. I would say, however, to Walt, I said, Walt, it didn't start with that mouse. It started with a word that you made up along the way. And Lee, that word was stick-to-it-ivity.
Stick-to-itivity.
It's not in the dictionary, although it should be, but that's Disney-ese for hanging in there, for persevering, for using tenacity. And when I study Walt, that's really the key to everything with him, Lee, that doggedness, that determination, persistence. You know, he just wouldn't quit. He just kept hanging in there.
He wouldn't quit.
Just kept battling. That's I think that's the story of Walt.
Pat, I want to play for you a clip from the PBS series American Experience about Walt Disney and that pal of his that you were just talking about, that mouse named Mickey.
Walt Disney always talked about Mickey Mouse as being his alter ego. He would say that, you know, I'm closer to Mickey Mouse than I am to anyone else.
Hey, Poodle, here she comes!
Mickey and Walt are talking to each other.
Hey, Poodle, here she comes!
So he's got to do Mickey's voice. Someone's got to do it. So, of course, Walt does it, because it's him talking to himself. So, Mickey, how you feeling today?
You know, I feel great. Do you know, it wasn't an easy day. You know, maybe tomorrow, who knows? You know, let's get into a little bit of trouble. You and me.
That was Neil Gabler and also Ron Suskind, both two terrific writers, as you know. Pat, and talk a little bit about that relationship and that creativity and the depths to which Mickey was, in some respects, a part of and an alter ego of Walt Disney. By the way, we learned this about Charles Schulz, too, Pat, that it turns out that Linus wasn't his alter ego. It was Charlie Brown himself that was Charles Schulz's alter ego. And speak to that, if you could.
Well, Lee, I guess that's the story of animators, isn't it? They actually become the characters that they're drawing or writing or filming, you know. And that was certainly the case with Walt. He had Mickey's voice down, created different scenarios for Mickey, loved Mickey more than any human being. I often wonder, did he love Mickey more than Lillian? That would be a good discussion. But that mouse was the centerpiece of his life. And I'll tell you what, Lee, I live right here in Orlando in the middle of Disney World, and I often wonder, what a miracle. Way back, they create this little mouse, and today he owns the world. We had 62 million visitors to Orlando last year, and they all want to see Mickey Mouse.
All because of a mouse. When we come back, more with Pat Williams, this remarkable story. And by the way, a uniquely American story, folks, so as all these stories are on Our American Stories. When we come back, more with Pat Williams, more on Walt Disney himself. On this day in history, the great Walt Disney died. Celebrating the life of Walt Disney. Born in 1901, died on this day in history in 1956. And we're joined by Pat Williams for the hour. Pat is the author of a great book, How to Be Like Walt. He's also the senior vice president and co-founder of the Orlando Magic. So he knows just a little bit about, well, Walt Disney. And in fact, if anything, this may have been, Pat, the biggest influence on your life, it sounds to me, in terms of the amount of time you spent, other than perhaps Jesus Christ. I don't think there's another person that's influenced you more. Am I right say that?
That's a great point. You know, obviously, I've had influences in my life from a men that I worked with or who became mentors, but Walt has become a real mentor in my life. He's become an inspiration. He's become a motivator, you know, just through talking to people who knew him, reading extensively about him. And he's become a huge part of my life. And Lee, I'll tell you, one of the people that really came alongside of me was Walt's daughter. And Diane Disney Miller, she became quite a hero. As I was working on that book, she was very generous with her time with me, and then put me in touch with all of her children, Walt and Lillian's grandchildren. And I was able to speak to them, you know, in doing my research for that book, How to Be Like Walt. And then on the opening day of the Walt Disney Family Museum, which Diane had overseen in San Francisco, I was invited to go to the opener of that museum. And boy, what a thrill that was.
Yeah, what an honor that's got to be. What an honor. You bet.
And I got to meet Diane and see her. Let me tell you this. She was a spitting image of her father. I mean, if you wanted to know what Walt looked like, just go look at Diane.
That's great.
And then I was so saddened a few years later. She had a fall, a bad fall, and she died at age 79. And I'm still very sad about that.
Well, Pat, I wanted to start off with another clip from the PBS American Experience. And this one is about Walt's salesmanship.
American Motors, builders of Nash Automobiles, Kelvinator Home Appliances, and Hudson Motor Cars present Walt Disney's Disneyland.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
Each week as you enter this timeless land, one of these many worlds will open to you. Here now to tell you about it is Walt Disney.
Welcome. I guess you all know this little fella here. It's an old partnership.
I think he was one of the great salesmen of our time because he never tried to sell something he didn't personally believe in.
Now we want you to share with us our latest and greatest dream. That's it, right here. Disneyland, seen from about 2,000 feet in the air and 10 months away.
Pat, salesman is a word many people look down on. But you say that Walt Disney's life proves that we shouldn't. And I might add that few people are artists and salesmen. Talk about both of those things, if you could.
Well, Lee, I think it's important to talk about the genius of Walt Disney in this regard. He had wonderful ideas. He was always thinking, always creating, always planning, you know. But he also, and there are many people like that, not to his extent, but many people. But Walt always knew what the public would buy. That was part of his genius. So he would create, but in creating, he also had a sense, he had a feel for what the public would buy. Because he was a businessman as well.
You bet.
And when he would create a new film or create Disneyland or whatever he was creating, equally of importance to him was, will the public pay for this? Will they buy it?
You bet. And he had a feel for it.
And that's where his salesman came in. Plus, just an instinct on what the public wanted.
Yeah, and he must have had a great feel for the country and obviously a great love for his country as well. Not a cynic as far as his view of American values and what the American people valued, Pat.
Well, Lee, there's no question about that. All you had to do was go to Disneyland and, you know, the Hall of Presidents and that wonderful speaking Mr. Lincoln. I think that goes back probably to his Midwestern roots. Remember, he spent a good bit of time on a farm in Marceline, Missouri, which was really probably the highlight of his youth. And he really got a sense of Middle America, I think, through that experience.
You had a great quote in here. You talked about his salesmanship, and you said, a great salesman lives on repeat business, and the key to repeat business is trust, and the key to trust is integrity, Anybody can sell to one customer one time. A great salesman builds relationships of trust on a foundation of truth. And you also added that Imagineer Harriet Burns told you, Walt was a great salesman and his best sales technique was his absolute honesty. He didn't use glib talk or flashy sales methods. He simply sold his ideas with honesty and sincerity. People could tell that he said what he meant and meant what he said. They trusted him, and that trust relationship made him a great salesman. Talk about that, Pat. I think it's so beautifully said.
Isn't that beautiful? You know, and I think that's a good challenge for any of us who are in the sales business, that we've got to be trustworthy. And I go back, way back, Lee, to my early days as a minor league baseball executive. I worked for a man in Spartanburg, South Carolina, Mr. Ari Littlejohn. He was the owner of the team. He used to say to me, there are many, many one-shot salesmen out there. They can come in and sell one time. But to come back a second time, that's the key as to whether you're a good salesman.
And, you know, the other kind of selling, Pat, and this is very important selling, is not only the external sale to the client or the customer, but it's the internal sale to your own team members, to your employees, to your executives. Talk about Walt's talent there. When we come back on the other side of a break, Pat, I'm going to play a great clip. But talk about that other kind of selling to your own people.
Well, if they're not enthused, Lee, if they're not excited about what they're doing, if they're not into it, I guess they can get the work done, but it's not going to be as it should be.
Yeah, they're going to just be moping along.
Walt had the ability to get his people excited, enthusiastic, and it really triggered from his passion, his zeal. You know, it was infectious. They caught it from Walt. If they saw Walt all pumped up and really into it, well, that spread like wildfire across his organization.
Well, one of Walt's greatest sales feats is selling Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs to his animators. We're going to play a clip right now that we had promised, Pat.
One evening in 1934, Walt sent his entire staff out for an early dinner, but told them to hurry back to the Hyperion soundstage for an important company meeting. The room was buzzing by the time Walt took the stage.
Disney is lit on the soundstage, and he then proceeds to act out alone, just him, a one-man show, the story of Snow White.
What he did was to go through the whole movie as he saw it, acting out all of the parts, impersonating all of the characters, going through all the emotions, all the ups and downs, the queen, the princess, the seven dwarves, even the animals.
Walt's excitement was catching. We were just carried away, remembered one animator. I would have climbed a mountain full of wildcats to do everything I could to make Snow White.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Walt Disney, for the hour. He died on this day in history in 1966. We're joined with Pat Williams, and when we come back, we'll have Pat comment on that remarkable clip. Again, this is Lee Habib. We'll be right back.
You undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps.
This is Lee Habib, and for the hour, we're talking about the life and death of Walt Disney, who died on this day in history in 1966. And joining us for the hour, Pat Williams, who has written so many books on leadership, and wrote the best book that I've read on Walt, How to Be Like Walt, because there's so much insight about so many aspects and dimensions of his life. Pat, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the fact that he was a sort of a servant-based manager, and he did a lot of managing by walking around. Talk about those two things and how he managed folks and got the maximum performance out of them.
Well, I think that's a key to being a good leader, Lee. the ability to get away from your desk or out of your silo and get down among the people. For example, George Washington during the Revolutionary War, 8 years, Lee, he never left his troops.
Yep.
Walt, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., where was he? Well, he was out among the people. Well, that was Walt. He was down among the animators. He would visit with them. He wouldn't overrule them. He would not be a pest to them, but he was. They knew he was there, that he was interested, that he was checking on things. And then, of course, Lee, when Disneyland opened, oh, my goodness, Walt was out among the crowds. He would generally wear a disguise of some sort so he wouldn't get mobbed. But he wanted to know what the public was thinking and what they were, how they were reacting. And Walt just loved to be out among the people and out among his own people. He inspired them. He got them pumped up. They loved his presence. Now, having said that, Walt was not the easiest boss in the world, Lee. You know, he was very sparse with his praise. If he said, that'll work, that was high praise from
right,
Walt.
Right.
He had his own style of leadership and how to do things. But if he said, that'll work, oh, listen, his employees would hear that. They'd be thrilled. That would keep him going for a year. So he had an interesting way of leading. But you have to say at the end of the day, it was extraordinarily effective.
You bet. It wasn't just the people he served either, Pat. It was the art he served. And it required him to take a big dose of humility and make quite a lot of selfless decisions, didn't it?
Oh, I think that's true. You know, I don't think there's any question about it. I think at the end of the day, you would describe Walt as a humble man. You know, I don't think he was stuck on himself. I don't think he listened to people. He wanted other people's ideas. But when he had a big one, nothing was going to deter him.
Right.
Even though people thought he was probably crazy, I love the Art Linkletter story. Art Linkletter was probably Walt's closest friend away from the studio. So one Saturday, Walt said, Art, come with me. I want to show you something down here in Orange County. And so they drove down to this open field and citrus trees and swamp, marsh, bog land, who knows. And they took a walk around, and Walt showed exactly to Art Linkletter what he was working on and where everything would go here for Disneyland. Well, they walked back to the car, and Art Linkletter was there with Walt, and Walt said, Art, you want to go in with me on the deal? And Art said, I think I'll pass, Walt. Later, Art Linkletter said, every step back to the car that day cost me $3 million a step, he said. And then later, years later, Walt came to him again and wanted to talk about a theme park, another Disneyland in Florida, and asked Art's opinion. And Art said, oh, Walt, that'll never work. Just like there's one Grand Canyon, you know, there's only one Disneyland.
Right.
And Art later said, from that point on, Walt just stopped asking me about my opinions.
That's a great story. You know, I wanted to read something from your book, getting back to that humility part. During 1925, Walt fired himself as an animator. Quote, I was never happy with anything I ever did as an artist, he once reflected. From then on, Walt would serve as producer, director, coach, cheerleader, head storyteller. But as you write in your book, he would never animate another frame of film. Fascinating that one of the great animators in history fired himself from the animation department.
Yeah, because he knew that wasn't his greatest strength. He knew he had a team of animators who were absolutely the very best in their profession. And Walt could draw, and he was a decent animator, but not at that level. And so he concentrated totally on the other things. And at that point, that company was growing, Lee. And he didn't have time to just sit there, you know, doing animation. He had much bigger things that he had to contend with and worry about.
Bigger dreams to deal with. You also talked in your book, Pat, about his service to art sometimes costing him dearly in the profit department, and how Roy was always constantly worried about that. I want to read again from your book. Roy worried about the cost of Walt's quest for excellence. In 1930, the cost of one cartoon was $5,400. By 1931, it more than doubled to $13,500. In 1932, Technicolor raised the price to around $23,000, $3,500 more than the advance from United Artists. Disney's costs were so high that it took 2 years for a cartoon to show a profit. Talk about the brothers. You had one who seemed to be the ledger guy, yet another guy who is the dreamer. How did that work out?
Oh, Lee, I think the Walt and Roy Disney story is fascinating unto itself. The two brothers, Roy was the older brother, and you're right, Lee. Walt was the creator. He was the imagination guy. He was worried. He concentrated on all of the product. Roy, somehow it had to be paid for. And Roy was the businessman. And he was the one that had to finance Walt's dream. Sometimes they really got into it and had some major disagreements. But in many other cases, Roy would come to the rescue and come up with a plan where his younger brother's dreams could be paid for. But it is fascinating the way the two of them work together. Without Roy, we probably wouldn't know much about Walt Disney today.
You bet.
It's kind of like Hewlett and Packard, right? You know, a business team. It's probably like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger.
Yep.
It's like Rich DeVos and Jay Van Andel with Amway. It's like Frank Wells and Michael Eisner later at Disney. Those remarkable teams, two-man teams that made things happen.
Yeah, no, we're close to and are very grateful for Bernie Marcus's support, and he would tell you that that team, he and Arthur Blank, that he couldn't have done what he could have done building Home Depot without Arthur, and also without Ken Langone, who ended up running around and getting their dreams financed. I wanted to talk about Walt Disney and his desire to serve God, and especially God's young children. Talk about this dimension of Walt Disney's life. I don't hear much about this, Pat.
Well, he grew up in a church-going home. You know, his mother and dad were both active in the church, and he grew up in that world. I think he knew the Lord, Lee. He didn't talk about it, and I'm not sure that he was a consistent churchgoer, but I think he knew that God played a big role in what he was doing, and it was all part of, I guess, maybe of his American heritage. But I think there was a definitely a spiritual part of his life.
To close the hour, Pat, Walt Disney shares the best advice he could ever give to young artists, and really, well, to all of us.
The best advice I have ever given to students who have studied under me has been just this. Educate yourself. Do not let me educate you. I'm reading from Robert Henri in response to a question often asked in letters from art students. However they put it, it always boils down to this. Students become confused by honest admiration for one school of painting mixed with recognition of the success and popularity of another style, along with advice to follow a still different approach. Frequently, a student will ask which one he should imitate. Robert Henri would advise, don't imitate anyone. He says, one of the great difficulties of an art student is to decide between his own natural impressions and what he thinks should be his impressions. And in another page, go forward with what you have to say, expressing things as you see them. Time after time in his art spirit, Henri says, be yourself.
Pat, 30 seconds. We're closing out the hour right now. Final thoughts about Walt Disney and what you just heard.
Great advice, isn't it? Be yourself. You can't be anybody else. God made each one of us uniquely. We're just like snowflakes. There are no two that are the same. And that's good advice to all of us, and great advice for young people. Don't be imitating others. You're a unique being, be yourself and carve your own path and do your own thing. Be your own self. Boy, that's solid advice from Walden. What a great way to end our hour together, Lee.
You bet. Pat, thank you so much for joining us, as always. The author of How to Be Like Walt, Senior Vice President of the Orlando Magic, co-founder as well. And also, remember that great Oscar Wilde line, Pat, be yourself, everyone else is taken. Thanks so much for joining us this hour, as always. Pat Williams, have a great night.
Lee, thank you so much.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Walt Disney. What a life it was. Died on this day in history in 1966.
Hi!
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're talking today about the life and career of Walt Disney, who passed away on this day in history in 1966. Walt Disney was an international celebrity by the time he was 30, hailed a genius before he was 40, with honorary degrees from Harvard and Yale. He built a media and entertainment company that stands as one of the most powerful on the planet. He won more Academy Awards than anybody in history, created a cinematic art form, and invented a new kind of American vacation destination. Born in Chicago to itinerant parents, Walt Disney was still a few months shy of his 18th birthday when he returned from France after World War I in 1919. He had banked over $500 and had a place waiting for him at a Chicago jelly factory where his father was part owner. The job was the best most working-class boys could hope for, but Walt Disney was not like most working-class boys. Here's Disney animator Don Hahn and biographer Neil Gabler.
He's got all these ideas, and he starts acting on them. And where most people are ready, aim, fire, he was like, ready, fire, aim. You know, he's like, let's go.
Walt loved attention. He was an extrovert. He loved to be the center of attention. He wants to be an artist. And I think he discovered something early on. That talent was his way of getting attention. He's a man of the times, and the times are exciting.
Walt was determined to do work he loved, and he had been an enthusiastic artist and cartoonist from the time he was little. He took a pass on factory work and headed for Kansas City instead, where he had spent much of his boyhood. He moved into a house with two of his older brothers and landed a job as a commercial artist for a local ad company. His only formal training was a few months at an art school in Chicago and a course at the Kansas City Art Institute. But he was convinced he could make better than what he was seeing. At age 20, Disney quit his day job and started a company, Laugh-O-Grams, Inc. He hired a salesman, a business manager, and four young apprentice animators. Here's Disney animator Don Hahn.
I can imagine a young Walt Disney just, you know, waking up at dawn and going out with his friends and saying, well, let's shoot this, let's film this. And that kind of hunger for not just expressing himself, but finding out who he was. He couldn't do enough.
He has stars in his eyes. He thinks he can do anything and everything that he wants. He has big plans. He's going to conquer the world.
Disney and his Laugh-O-Grams crew secured a contract for six animated shorts. But when they delivered the work, the distributor stiffed them. Walt could no longer make payroll or pay the rent on his office. He insisted he had discovered the means for an escape. His big idea was to insert footage of a real girl into animated scenes, Alice in Cartoonland. Walt was able to scrape together just enough cash to complete Alice. He finished his cartoon experiment with little help while sleeping at the office, bathing at a train station, living on canned beans. But by the time the cartoon short was finished in the summer of 1923, it was too late. His company was headed for bankruptcy court. Alice in Cartoonland would not save Laugh-O-Grams, Inc. Walt Disney had suffered his first real failure. He packed his cardboard suitcase with two spare shirts and what was left of his drawing supplies, then headed for Union Station, where he treated himself to a first-class ticket on the Santa Fe California Limited, straight through to Los Angeles. Shortly after arriving in L.A., Margaret Winkler, the only woman in the business, had remembered Walt's Alice in Cartoonland pitch. She wanted Walt to make 12 Alice shorts and was willing to pay $1,500 an episode. Here's biographer Neil Gabler.
When he gets that telegram, the first thing he does is he goes to visit his brother Roy. And Walt is waving this telegram saying, "Look, we've got a chance here." Now, his brother is not enthusiastic. His brother has no entertainment ambitions whatsoever. His brother is the pragmatist. But Walt says, "You know, we can do this. I need you for this." Roy, as much as he was a naysayer, he loved the enthusiasm of Walt, and I think he thrived on it. He got joy from participating in the kind of wild schemes of his brother that he himself would never have concocted. Roy got release, and Walt got protection.
What a great line. Roy got release, Walt got protection. But what a remarkable story about two brothers. I don't know that it's ever been made a movie, but my goodness, preparing for this, we learned a remarkable story about the love of two brothers and how they served each other to create this remarkable life and enterprise. The two brothers scraped up a little cash from friends and relatives and set up a two-man operation in the back of a real estate office. Walt was the artist and idea man, Roy the fundraiser, the bookkeeper, and all-around utility man. Disney was obsessed with his rivals in the cartoon industry by the end of 1926. He could tell his Alice pictures were running out of steam and spent much of his free time assessing and taking aim at Felix the Cat. The key to challenging Felix the Cat was creating his own compelling and likable character. Disney's distributor suggested he try a rabbit. Lead animator Iwerks took charge of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit's look, while Disney wrote the storylines. The bosses at Universal Pictures were so taken with the first sketches of Oswald, they offered a contract for 26 episodes. Walt Disney Studios seemed to be riding high, but by the time the team put the finishing touches on the first order of Oswald shorts, the animators were increasingly frustrated with the boss. The old Kansas City hands who had helped Disney get started in the business, and often without pay, were working into the night and through the weekends. Charles Mintz, Margaret Winkler's new husband and business partner, saw an opportunity, emboldened by the knowledge that he owned the rights to Oswald, and the Disney brothers did not. And when we come back, we're going to hear more about this story of betrayal and survival. This day in history, Walt Disney died in 1966. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More when we come back. Right after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, the life of Walt Disney, as our This Day in History series, sponsored by Hillsdale College, celebrates the life and death of Walt Disney, who died on this day in 1966. And we were just telling the story about how his distributor's husband, Charles Mintz, had basically, stolen just about everything, the crew, the work, right out from under Walt Disney's, his whole life. Well, here's biographer Neil Gabler and historian Stephen Watts talking about this tragic episode.
Bob Iwerks comes to Walt Disney and says, "Walt, I've been approached by Charles Mintz to essentially leave you and to go to work for Mintz. And I'm not the only one. All of the animators have. But they haven't told you.
Disney doesn't believe it. He just sort of poo-poos the whole thing and doesn't really believe Bob Iwerks, who says, you know, there's a problem brewing here.
And there was. Walt went to New York in February of 1928 with big hopes for a new contract for Mintz. But Mintz had already poached almost all of Disney's artists. And the distributor told Walt he was going to go on making the Oswald cartoons without him. When Disney boarded the train for the trip back to Los Angeles, he was despondent. Almost all of his team had abandoned him. He had no distributor, no Oswald, and almost no money in the bank. When Walt arrived at Union Station in Los Angeles in mid-March 1928, Ub Iwerks detected none of his friends' trademark good cheer and enthusiasm. Disney's skeleton team scoured popular magazines for inspiration, bounced ideas off one another, and drew figures on their sketch pads until a little mouse began to emerge. Disney was unable to find a distributor willing to take a chance on his first two Mickey shorts, but Walt refused to give up on his mouse. At a meeting with Roy one day, Walt suddenly blurted out, "We'll make them over with sound." Here are film historians Sarah Nelson and Eric Smoodin.
How can I do something better with animation than what everybody else is doing? He's always the person looking for new technology. He's always the person trying to find the newest invention to make animation better.
At the time, producing a soundtrack in sync with and music that makes sense with the action on screen is very difficult. This was a very precise and intricate process that Disney had to think through. And also, it's unclear that the money it costs to make a sound film can possibly pay off with tickets sold.
Well, that never deterred Walt Disney, did it? A determined Walt Disney with his skeleton crew, well, they just did it. He didn't have enough money in New York, but he didn't have enough in the bank to pay for the recording sessions. So he wired Roy to do whatever he had to get the cash. He told his brother to sell his car if needed. Walt searched desperately for a distributor. He carried his reels from one office to another for 3 long months and came up empty. He did manage to secure a 2-week run at the Colony Theater, Broadway and 53rd. Steamboat Willie premiered on November 18, 1928. The crowd at the Colony Theater was, well, blown away. A few audiences begged the projectionist to delay the start of the main feature and rerun Steamboat Willie. Mickey was a multi-talented charmer, a dancer, a comedian, a singer, and within months, Mickey Mouse was the newest Hollywood celebrity. While the country slid toward economic disaster in 1930, the fame of the Disney Mouse just kept growing. Here are historians Carmenita Higginbotham and Ron Suskind.
Mickey Mouse is scrappy. Mickey Mouse is a survivor. Mickey Mouse is somebody during the years of the Depression who takes a limited number of skills and a limited number of resources, and he always ends up on top.
Mickey's a little bit in your face. Mickey's like, "Hey, I'm smart. I can do anything. I get into trouble, but I get out of it. I'm sort of rebellious. You know, I live by my own rules." He's an adolescent dream is what he is. Rebelling and making it work. That's Mickey.
Rebelling and making it work. By the early 1930s, fans could buy Mickey-adorned merchandise by the scores. The Mickey Mouse watch became the most popular timepiece in America. Here's historian Eric Smoodin and animator Don Hahn.
Mickey is understood as being the creation of Disney, and Disney is understood as being the father of Mickey, and combined, that makes for a kind of international stardom that we really hadn't seen before.
When everybody else is suffering, Walt Disney is selling consumer products and making millions of dollars out of Mickey Mouse. And that's a huge story that this little mouse turns into the future of the Walt Disney Company.
Walt was not yet 30, and he had made himself the first celebrity of animation, a film cartoonist the public could name. His studio stood atop the industry and was growing to meet the demand for new Mickey material. Walt had talked of having a big family of his own for 4 years. He wanted 10 children, he would tell his sister, and he would spoil them all. Walt's wife, Lillian, had her doubts about raising any number of children, especially when she considered the office hours Walt kept. But he talked her into it, and by the spring of 1931, Lillian was pregnant, and Walt, well, he was giddy. He was already making plans for a bigger house to accommodate the new addition. And then, a major setback. Lillian miscarried. Disney waved off the well-wishers and sympathizers and threw himself back into his work. He insisted he was fine, but he wasn't.
In 1931, I had a hell of a breakdown. I went all to pieces. It was just pound, pound, pound. It was costs. My costs were going up, and I was always way over whatever they figured the pictures would bring in. And I cracked up. I just got very irritable. I got to a point that I couldn't talk on the telephone. I'd begin to cry. And the least little thing, I'd just go that way.
And that was Walt Disney himself. I went all to pieces. I had a hell of a breakdown, he confessed. In October 1931, Walt Disney took his doctor's advice and escaped on the first real vacation of his life. He and Lillian went across the country to Washington, D.C., then all the way south to Key West, and on to a week's stay in, of all places, Cuba. They rode a steamship through the Panama Canal on the way back to Los Angeles. Once home, Disney told people that the breakdown had been a godsend. Life was sweet, he said, and there was more to it than work. He dove into a new exercise regimen, went with Lillian on long horseback rides, learned to play polo, and joined a league. Here's biographer Neil Gabler talking about Walt's recovery from his nervous breakdown.
Walt comes back from his nervous breakdown, and he does change his lifestyle, but does Walt Disney withdraw? Does he delegate? Does he do the things that one might have expected him to do? No, he does not.
Walt got back into his work using up his earliest Mickey profits in the creation of a new series of cartoon shorts called Silly Symphonies. Silly Symphonies raised Walt to near mythic status among cartoonists and animators. Artists from all over the country packed their bags and headed for California just for the chance to work with the great Walt Disney. The Disney studio staff grew to nearly 200. Here's biographer Neil Gabler.
Walt intended the studio to be the place where you created great art. That was so instrumental to Walt's understanding of the studio. And that became, in many ways, the most powerful element in how he dealt with his workers. They wanted to produce great things. He made them want to produce great things.
They wanted to produce great things, and he made them want to produce great things. This is Lee Habib, and we're talking about the life of Walt Disney, who died on this day in 1966, and it's brought to you by our great partners at Hillsdale College, who, if there is a college in America to study life, history, philosophy, moral philosophy, and United States history and the story of this great country, now, there's no better place than Hillsdale College. And when we come back, more about the man, the myth, the life of the great Walt Disney. And if you'd like to hear more, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org, where all of these stories are posted. And you can just stream and listen. We'll be back after this.
When you wish upon a star as dreamers.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. You're listening to the remarkable soundtrack from Fantasia. And we're talking about Walt Disney for the hour, his life, his art, his work. And he passed on this day in history in 1966, and that's why we're talking about him. And we left off, we were talking about Walt and what kind of a guy he was and how he inspired his crew. And he also wasn't the typical bigwig. There was no calling him Mr. Disney around the studios, for instance. Here's what a couple of Walt's animators had to say about his etiquette at the workplace.
He was very jovial. He was very informal. He's the one who first insisted on only being referred to by his first name.
Boss? He wasn't a boss. He was a friend. And everybody called him Walt. If they didn't call him Walt, that was the end of that one.
In fact, calling him Mr. Disney might have gotten you fired. But for the most part, the studios were a place where you could make mistakes and not have to worry about losing your job. Here's animator Don Hahn.
He was always very much about not only hiring the artists, but providing a safe place for them to do their job. And by safe, I mean a place to make mistakes and a place to fail and a place to take criticism without the fear of being fired and a place to be able to learn.
Walt Disney, not yet 35, his studio was a Technicolor rainbow in the middle of the pale gray depression era America. His home life was thriving too. Lillian had given birth to a daughter, Diane, and the Disneys would soon adopt a second daughter, Sharon. One evening in 1934, Walt sent his entire staff out for an early dinner, but told them to hurry back to the soundstage for an important company meeting. The room was buzzing by the time Walt took the stage. Here's Neil Gabler and Stephen Watts.
Disney is lit on the soundstage, and he then proceeds to act out alone, just him, a one-man show, the story of Snow White.
What he did was to go through the whole movie as he saw it, acting out all of the parts, impersonating all of the characters, going through all the emotions, all the ups and downs, the queen, the princess, the seven dwarves, even the animals.
What Disney was proposing had never been done before, never even tried. A feature-length, story-driven cartoon.
In the shorter cartoons, you can make people laugh. And the gag is the basic component of these things. You get people to laugh. But Walt Disney now is asking another question. Can you make people cry? Can you make people cry over a drawing?
The production process did not change. Key animators would draw the main characters in Snow White. In-betweeners would draw the movements between the key frames. The ink and paint artists would add color to the drawings and transfer them to the transparent sheets or cells to go to camera. At 24 frames per second, and often multiple cells per frame, Snow White would require more than 200,000 separate drawings. The Disneys had already built a two-story addition at Hyperion, but it wasn't nearly enough. Roy was forced to rent bungalows and other buildings in the neighborhood just to accommodate their staff, which grew to more than 600 people. As the production dragged into its second and then its third year, Walt's demands began to look dangerous. He repeatedly pushed deadlines, and by the start of 1937, with the premiere set for that December, the studio was behind, way behind. 10 months to the premiere date, and not a single animation cell had been shot on film. But Walt insisted that Snow White could not be rushed and could not be done on the cheap. Walt kept upping the ante, which meant Roy had to raise Walt's original budget number 6 times over. The trade papers were beginning to write stories about the delays. People were calling Snow White Disney's folly. Roy was worried they may be right. Here, some of the original animators talk about the heavy workload.
I was working the 12-hour deal, where you come in at 8 and go home at 8. And we really were cleaning cells and patching cells, fixing mistakes and things like that, and there were a lot. And the queen had the kind of paint that was kind of sticky. And so those things would come back from camera, and we'd have to clean them up and patch them and send them back to camera.
I worked my tail off.
I was put in charge of the cleanup and in-between. That's where it was lagging. We went in at 7 instead of 8. And we went to dinner, and we came back and usually worked till almost 10.
The ink and paint gals were, you know, some of them were losing their eyesight, and it was a hell of a thing. They were just slaves. They were doing it. But they believed in this thing so much they were going to drop dead on the job.
The animators finished in early November, but the last cells weren't painted until November 27th. Rumors were flying around Hollywood that there would be no print of the film ready for the December 21st premiere. This was Walt's first attempt to make a feature-length cartoon. Remember, something that was unheard of at the time. Walt paced back and forth and shook like a leaf in nervousness as these dates approached, according to staff that were around him at the time of the actual premiere.
Blasé Hollywood, accustomed to gala openings, turns out for the most spectacular of them all, the world premiere of the $1.5 million fairy tale fantasy, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Replicas from the first feature cartoon thrill thousands who turn out for a glimpse of lovely Marlene Dietrich with Doug Fairbanks Jr. and a parade of stars. Shirley Temple is just as enthralled as are the grown-up stars and moviegoers with the seven fantastic dwarfs.
Walt was in a state of high anxiety. He had no idea how the audience was going to respond.
Well, Walt, I think you're due to do all the talking tonight. Tell us a little bit about this picture, will you?
Well, it's been a lot of fun making it. We're very happy that it's being given this big premiere here tonight. All these people are turning out to take a look at it, and I hope they're not too disappointed.
Well, I'm sure they won't be. I've seen the picture, Walt, and you're going to be...
He didn't know if it would really work, and one part of him was almost agonizing over, well, if people don't buy this, this will just fall flat, and then I will be done.
Audience members gasped at the opening shots of the Queen's castle.
Slave in the magic mirror, come from the farthest space. Through wind and darkness, I summon thee. Speak.
They howled in laughter at the antic dwarfs.
Just a minute.
The heart of a pig. And I've been tricked.
Well, as you can imagine, Walt sitting in the audience, just mortified, gripping Lillian's hand for nearly 75 minutes, his bride, nervously anticipating the scene that would put the power of his personal vision to the ultimate test.
You know, he perished in the land.
When it arrived, the apparent death of Snow White, the theater was hushed. And remember, could a cartoon make people cry? What a gamble. When we come back, we're going to hear about how it paid off, but you already know how it paid off. This is Lee Habib, the life story of Walt Disney on this day in history. Walt Disney died in 1966. This is Our American Stories. You're listening to the music from Snow White. When we left off on this story of the premiere of Snow White, got to that scene where Walt was trying to make the folks cry. And the apparent death of Snow White was that scene. And here is biographer Neil Gabler and Ron Suskind, the writer.
The audience started weeping. And that's when Walt knew. That's when they all knew. The audience had suspended its disbelief so thoroughly, so believed in the reality of the situation and of the dwarves, that they were crying. That was really the triumph of the film.
Clark Gable and Carol Lombard are weeping. They don't know what hit them. You know, what hit them is that they crossed a barrier from the life they live to the internal world where myth lives in all of us. And Disney provides the passage. And it ain't kid stuff.
And when the curtain came down, the audience rose from their seats and broke into a thunderous ovation. Quote, "I could not help but feel," one rival movie producer gushed, "that I was in the midst of motion picture history." Writer Richard Schickel points out that while Snow White made children wet their pants, at least they had an experience.
Think about what he does. Well, he's like, oh, these cartoons don't have to be just slapstick. They can carry everything, all the biggest stuff. They can carry ancient and powerful mythologies. They can carry everything.
My hands.
That was a huge leap, and that's an artistic leap. He's creating a new art form.
And that's exactly what he did. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs played at New York's Radio City Music Hall for five straight weeks at the beginning of 1938. And by the way, that music hall seats 7,500 people. No other film had ever run more than three. National and international releases followed, lines wrapped around small theaters in New England, the South, the Midwest, and the Far West. The film was a box office smash in London, Paris, and Sydney, and it grossed $8 million in the first year, the equivalent of $100 million today, and more than any film before it. Roy paid off the studio's $2.3 million debt to the Bank of America while the film was still in its first run and helped oversee an unprecedented merchandising campaign. Snow White was Walt's first international hit, and he went on to create many more, some more successful than others, others that were total flops. Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia, Dumbo, Bambi, Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, Robin Hood, Peter Pan, Lady and the Tramp, Old Yeller, Sleeping Beauty, 101 Dalmatians, The Sword and the Stone, and Mary Poppins. It's just remarkable. What an American story. And a uniquely American story. By the way, we'll be talking about the Wright brothers soon. Another, as David McCulloch, the historian, said, uniquely American story. He said the Wright brothers could have only happened in America. And we love telling those stories. Well, by the early 1960s, Disney's company was bigger than ever, with money to burn. But Walt was as restless as ever, and driven as always, and still difficult when things were going against him. With the large success of Disneyland in the far rearview mirror, Walt was well on the way to building Epcot Center at Disney World. On October 27, 1966, Walt spent the day on the studio soundstage shooting his part in a promotional film about his new pet project.
The most exciting, the far the most important part of our Florida project, in fact, the heart of everything we'll be doing in Disney World, will be our experimental prototype city of tomorrow. We call it Epcot.
Now, that was the salesman, Walt Disney, but that effort that you heard just there so winded the 64-year-old that he needed to take oxygen between his takes.
Nobody let us in on it. Maybe some of the inner circle might have known it was more serious, but I didn't. And then one day we were looking at a rough cut of this film, and Walt was there in the hall. And as he passed us in the hall, we were standing there, he looked at us and he said, "Keep up the good work, fellas." It's the first time and the only time he ever complimented our work. And he winked at us and walked down the hall.
Walt did not return to the studio as usual the next day. He checked himself back into the hospital instead. On the night of December 14th, 1966, Walt sent Lillian home from his bedside to get some rest. He promised her he was feeling stronger. Roy stayed behind and sat at the bedside while his kid brother, flat on his back, pointed up to the ceiling tiles, trying to explain the vision of Disney World and Epcot that shimmered before him, trying to make his brother Roy see it as he did. Quote, "Now there's where the highway will run," he explained. "And there's the route for the monorail."
I went down to get my hair cut, and it was a gal barbershop. And she was cutting my hair, and she says, "Too bad about Walt." And I said, "Oh, he's going to be okay. He'll be back next week." "No, he died." "Well, I couldn't get out of that chair quicker to get home. And my mother and my cousin are just like this. They wouldn't even talk to me." "Well, it was a bad day."
I was next door at the studio. And I rushed over and he was gone.
I heard somebody shrieking, and running down the hall was one of the secretaries. And I opened the door, and everybody was rushing into the hallway and said, "Walt died." Nobody could believe it. And we all gathered in Bill Anderson's office, a whole bunch of us. And they were crying. Our men were crying. I was crying. It was terrible. It was horrible. It was just horrible.
His brother Roy refused to retire. He was well in his 70s until the first phase of Walt Disney World was built. And Walt left behind an incredible legacy and shaped the way we think, the way we imagine, and the way we look at life as Americans. His impact on society is an immeasurable testament to the power of the imagination, the power of the individual, and the selfless dedication of one man's passion to bring people together with the art, storytelling, and celebration of following your dreams at any cost. Here are some closing thoughts from a few of the Disney historians we featured this hour.
Disney goes back and taps old myths and old narrative arcs that are deeply rooted in all of us. What is the meaning of my life? What is my journey really born of? How can I discover who I am?
He affects all of us. No one is untouched by Walt Disney.
There aren't that many figures in American culture who cover as many bases, who do as many things as Walt Disney. Disney was somebody who understood the American psyche. He was also someone who anticipated the future of the American psyche. He understood a whole lot about us.
Those are some great words. I'm going to repeat a few of them. No one is untouched by Walt Disney. And that's true. And Disney was somebody who understood the American psyche. He was also someone who anticipated the future of the American psyche. He understood a whole lot about us. And so we're going to go out where we started with that great voice. Satcho. Zippity-doo-dah from the Disney movie Song of the South. This is Lee Habib. Great work on this, Jesse. Great work on the whole team, Greg, Alex. This is the kind of storytelling you hear. Unique and uniquely American stories on Our American Stories. And if you'd like to hear any or all of this, please go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. Send it to friends. Send it to people you don't like. Have a great night.
Wonderful feeling, wonderful day.